Accession number 210144, Rule 3.
Frank Burton, Reel 3.
We dug in at Merville, and the next day we were being mortared or shelled by the Germans, and gradually each house in the village of Merville was being destroyed, and we had to get out, which we did. And I can remember more or less crawling through a cornfield or whatever. And we did get out quite successfully under the noses of the Germans. And later on that night, pitch dark, we reached a small village called the Plain, P-L-E-I-N, and there was the village church there, and we'd had no food hardly all this time because there was a heavy storm taking place in the channel and they weren't able to get supplies over to us. Anyway, we mustered round this church, absolutely pitch dark, you didn't know where you were or anything. And they got some food up to us. And I well remember they handed out one tin. In books I read, it said we had a hot meal, but we didn't have a hot meal. It was our first hot meal, it said. But I well remember we got one tin between two men. Whatever, any tin of anything. And Tom Corden and I, my friend, we got this tin which we opened, cut it in half, and it was probably something like a tin of steak and kidney. And I well remember I got the wrong end of the fat, which was very pleasant, but we ate it anyway. And we had to sleep the night in the church, all crowded into the church, pitch dark, you couldn't see, you were falling over everything. And I suppose the next day we moved off round the village, settled in round the village, the commando was settled in, and we dug in, I and several others were dug in an orchard. And I suppose we knew we were held up. We couldn't advance anymore. We were on the left flank of the whole landing. And when you think about it, I mean, the heaviest weapons a commando had was probably a heavy machine gun. And if the Germans had known that, I mean, they could have gone through us like a dose of salts, really. Anyway, we were dug in this orchard, coming under mortar fire, probably shell fire sometimes. We were moving around the village doing different things. We, of course, being signallers, if you stopped for a day or two at a place, you set up a small telephone exchange and ran telephone wires out to the different troops surrounded each troop in the commando, and we took it in turns to man the telephone exchanges amongst other jobs. And one day things were quiet and I had decided to do some washing. I had a shirt and a towel, and we used to catch a biscuit tin off the galley, from the galley, of course in the Royal Marines, we always used naval terms. The cookhouse was a galley. We always spoke of the galley. If you went out of an evening, you went ashore, even though you were on land all the time. Anyway, catch the biscuit tin off the galley, filled it with water, put a shirt in, built a little fire, and no sooner got it going than we came under mortar fire or shell fire, dived in the slit trench, which was quite deep. You dug a real good deep hole, because that was your little home. The firing ended. I got out the slit trench and my tin with my shirt and towel in was full of holes. The shirt was full of holes, the towel was full of holes. And this was about it, probably about a yard away from my slit trench. So if I hadn't been quick enough to get into the slit trench, I'd have been full of holes myself. And I can't remember how long we were in that orchard. Probably a week or two. You can't. Time meant nothing then. But I can remember one evening we came under a very heavy bombardment. Excuse me. And which lasted maybe half an hour, can't remember. It seemed like hours. Anyway, that finished, and the next day we were given orders, everybody had to be in their slit trenches by 6 o'clock, because they expected another lot. We were all in our slit trenches, and Tom Corden and I got a message that one of the telephone lines had been cut, and we were to go out and find this cut in the telephone line. Well, it wasn't a very nice thought to have to go out and find this break in the telephone line when you were expecting a heavy bombardment. But anyway, we found out, we went out and found the line, repaired it, and nothing happened, which was a great relief. And then, I suppose from then on, well, we eventually did move a bit further on, different small, they were all small villages you were in, you weren't hitting any big towns or anything like that. Caen was the nearest big town, which they couldn't capture. And we used to go out on patrols. There was the River Dives, I suppose you pronounced it, D-I-V-E-S. We used to go out patrols across there. And one day I was told to report. They were sending out a patrol. They'd already sent a patrol out across the river, and they got pinned down. So they set up this other patrol to go out to try and get them back. But we didn't succeed. We were pinned down ourselves. I don't know what happened to the other patrol in the end. But we came under heavy fire, probably mortar fire, but they were using shells or mortars that exploded in the air. So the shrapnel was falling down on you instead of coming at you. It was falling down on you. Anyway, we got out. And eventually we did begin to move. Things did begin to move. And we crossed this River Dives. And moved on, and we marched this particular night. We had to capture a hill. It was all flat country, but it was this one big hill that Germans occupied, they could see probably for miles around from the top of this hill. And we marched all night, or most of the night, single file. What they used to do, it was absolutely pitch dark, you couldn't see a thing, because there were no street lights at all, it was old country. And what they used to do, they would have men in the front of the line unreeling white tape. So you followed the tape, that's all you could see, was this white tape. Every so often, you would stop. All the men in front of you would stop. And you would drop off to sleep, standing up. Probably only for about 2 seconds. You'd wake up and there's nobody in front of you. So you'd have to start to double a bit, and everybody behind you would have to double. It probably happened to many chaps ahead of and behind of you. And we attacked this hill probably at dawn, I suppose. You used to have to catch the Germans when they were asleep or getting up or whatever. And that was quite a battle. I can remember the Germans used a lot of horses, big, like Shire horses, for carting things about. And I can remember these dead horses, which shocked me to see these great horses lying there dead. And we did capture the hill. And they got some food up to us. And I can well remember it was raining that morning. And we got some cold fried bacon. These are all things that stick in your mind. You just lay down and went to sleep. Pouring with rain, but Tom Corden, this friend of mine, he was a chap who could sleep anywhere. And we moved on from there. We moved on through Caen. Of course, they bombed Caen heavily. They flattened Caen. That was the only way they could capture it. And we went on through Caen. And I can't remember where we went after that. It wasn't far on after Caen, because it was decided then that our brigade would return to England to train for the Far East. So we came back to England in the September, this was. And went to Petworth, that's where we moved for a few days or whatever. And I didn't like the idea, the thought of going to the Far East. Probably thinking about the jungle. That's what I didn't like the thought of, having to fight through jungles. But we moved into Eastleigh Barracks at Portsmouth, probably to spruce it up a bit, but probably, I don't say the discipline had slipped, because we had good officers, and you were friends with the officers, you know, you relied on one another, you all helped one another. That was one of the things about the commandos, you were taught to be self-reliant. So you could, if you were on your own, you could manage. And I suppose thing, of course, we'd never done any drill in France, things like that, that didn't come into it at all. I suppose we went back to the barracks to spruce up a bit, do a bit of drill, and and get ready for this move to the Far East. They did start to issue equipment. I can remember getting a green vest. That was about the only jungle piece of equipment I got. And then sometime later, I think it was when the Germans broke through in the Ardennes, it was decided that we would go back to Europe. So we sailed to Ostend, landed at Ostend, and boarded lorries to move up to the front. I can remember disembarking from the lorries, and you could hear the guns, the heavy guns going. And I don't know about the others, but it frightened me a bit, hearing the guns, because you knew what you were going back into. Whereas D-Day, we'd no experience. I don't say we weren't frightened on D-Day, but you'd no experience. You didn't know what you were going into. But this time, going back, we knew what we were going back into, and you felt shaky. And we started to move up then. And Ostend, that's Belgium, I think, isn't it? We moved up, we got up into Holland. And small actions, I suppose. We were moving on, we were fighting. Of course, one of the main jobs of our brigade, anyway, was the assault crossings across the rivers. The Maas and the Rhine, the River Elbe, two or three others. There were five rivers. Some of us have got a special tie called the Five Rivers Tie that we're allowed to wear, if you want to. All those across the five rivers was entitled to wear this Five Rivers Tie. Some of these just came up after the war. And
did you still have the same job as CO's rover?
Yeah, I travelled around with the CO. And yeah, he was great to me. You do hear talk about a man not knowing fear. But I think everybody felt fear. But I'm convinced he never felt fear. He was a big man. He wasn't very popular with the officers. Because I can remember our signal officer telling me at one of our reunions that any officer told that he was going to join 4-5 Commando, tried to get out of it. But he was a great leader.
Why should he not have been popular with other officers?
Well, I suppose he... Perhaps it was discipline, I suppose. I don't say he was hard on his officers, but he drove them on. He was a great leader. And he was decorated. He won the DSO and bar, probably a couple of other decorations. But to me, he was fearless. I always felt safe with him.
And his name was Gray?
Nicol Gray, Colonel Nicol Gray.
How do you spell Nicol?
N-I-C-H-O-L. G-R-A-Y. N-I-C-H-O-L. Nicol Gray. His brother was commanding officer of 46 Commando, Tim Gray, his younger brother. I thought he was a great man, and most of the others did come to think of him that way. I think he he looked after our commando exceptionally well. And where were we then? We went.
So you said you were going to the Ardennes offensive.
No, we didn't go into the Ardennes. The Germans, well, they attacked mostly Americans there, because when you read about it, the Germans were dressed in American uniforms and infiltrated the American positions. And the Americans didn't know who was who.
So where did you go to?
Well, we moved up into Holland and went on. I thought we were heading for the Rhine crossings. But before the Rhine, I think it was probably January 1945, we were in, moving forward with opposition from the Germans, and Colonel Gray, this particular day, decided he wanted to go and see how E Troop were getting on, because he wasn't a man that would stop in the headquarter position. He wanted to get out and move around and see how the troops were getting on, the different positions. And he never called them Germans. He always used to say to me, "Come on, Burton, we're going out after the bad men." That's what he called them, the bad men. On this particular day, we set off. I think we had a runner with us, another chap acting as a runner. And we followed a German trench that they'd probably dug some time before. And it was quite a long trench, and we stayed down in this trench as far as long as we could, as far as it went. And of course we had to get up into the open then, crossing this open ground. And there were three or four tanks, small tanks, or armoured vehicles, moving up. And we came under fire. I don't know whether they were firing at the tanks or firing at our little group. But anyway, I got hit in the arm. Didn't feel a great deal of pain, but my arm just became absolutely useless. I couldn't lift it. I couldn't do anything with it. So I carried on, but eventually the CO, I suppose, realised that a one-arm signalling wasn't much good to him, so I went back to where our little dressing station was set up. They were all RAMC medics we had. This chap bound my arm up, and I didn't know it then, but I wasn't good to rejoin the CO. I was being sent back to a hospital base behind the lines.
Whereabouts in Holland did this happen?
It was an area called, I don't know whether there's a village there, it was an area called Brachterbeek. We were heading for a village called Lynn, Linne. And I sat there waiting. I had to wait for some transport to move me back. And I remember this chap giving me a mug of tea. And I took my cigarette tin out of my right-hand breast pocket. I didn't notice it at first, but I opened the tin and all my cigarettes were all just mashed up. And put the lid back on and realised there was a hole gone right through the cigarette tin. And thinking about it, the bullet had gone through the cigarette tin and wounded me in the arm. It was only a slight flesh wound. In fact, I only had a half-inch scar. I was in hospital in Brussels for 3 weeks. But they only had a little half-inch scar there. I often wondered how that little nick in the arm, as it was, could damage my arm so much, because I couldn't use the arm at all. It was completely useless.
You've shown me the Craven 8-in.
I showed you the Craven 8-in with the bullet hole in. And of course I had to, going back, I had to hand my, I was armed with a 45 Colt automatic, being a signal, we couldn't carry rifles. We weren't fighting men, actually. The Colt automatic was for your own protection. And I had to hand that in, and my spare magazines of ammunition, which I had on my belt, on my stomach, really, and took them out, and there was another bullet embedded in the magazine. Quite a big hole in the magazine. And I had the bullet, it did stop the bullet. How it didn't set the ammunition off, I don't know. Probably hit it from the side on. So it...
And you've also showed me that this morning.
I showed you the magazine. It's quite a hole in it. And I did have the bullet for a little while, but eventually lost it. Would have been nice to have, as a keepsake, souvenir. But then I went back, I eventually finished up back in Brussels in hospital for 3 weeks till their arm healed. And things were very short in the hospital. You didn't have lighting in the evenings, all the electricity would be turned off, water would be turned off. Anyway, the day came when the doctor told me I could rejoin my unit. So I went down, got my things together, went down to the desk at the hospital entrance and said, well, what do I do now? And they said to me, well, you go down to the railway station and report to the RTO, which were the military police, the army military police there, who would sort your return to your unit out. And this chap I saw, military police, he said, well, I can't help you, you're nothing to do with us, you're a Royal Marine. So you're nothing to do with the army. So I did try to argue with him, but he wouldn't have it. You're a Royal Marine. And thinking back, we were never bothered by the army military police when we were on railway stations going on leave. They didn't bother Royal Marines. And the naval police never bothered us at all. Anyway, he wouldn't have anything to do with me. So I just left. And found out where the naval HQ was in Brussels. Went to them, hoping that they might have transport going up into Holland, because I was in Belgium then, Brussels. Went to the naval HQ and they said, well, we can't help you, you're a Royal Marine. So I even went to the RAF headquarters in Brussels, see if they had any transport going to Holland. Ridiculous, really, probably. But left there and just started to wander around Brussels. Didn't know what to do. Had very little money. No food. Nowhere to go. And I happened to meet another chap from Liverpool who'd just come out from England as a reinforcement. And he said to me, well, I'm in the barracks here in Brussels, waiting to be posted to a unit. So he said, if you come in the barracks, he said, you get a bed and your meals as well, and nobody will ask you any questions. So this is what I did, found a bed, and we just wandered around Brussels in the daytime. And after a few days, I still didn't know what to do. He said to me that he'd got his orders to move on. So I said to him, it's no use me stopping here, I might as well come with you. So we got on the train. He had his papers, I had nothing. How I got on the train, I don't know. But anyway, we landed at this place, still in Belgium. Late at night, we were at a camp. We found a bed, just the two of us in this hut. Woke up the next morning, hear a lot of shouting and marching, stamping.